More than 80,000 chemicals are registered for use in the United States, and each year we add another 2,000. They go into foods, personal care products, prescription drugs, household cleaners, and lawn care products. Some are pesticides, toxic chemicals, intentionally released into our environment to kill living things, be they weeds, insects, fungus, or rodents. And while relatively few chemicals are thought to pose a significant risk to human health, which ones are they? And how are they being tested? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Meet Christine, who had some health challenges, the cause of which seemed elusive. Here's her story. Watch.
I would say I've always had a few issues here and there. I had acid reflux disease since I'm about 14 years old. And then, you know, that developed into some other issues probably over the course of the last 10 years. And about a year ago, I just had a lot of trouble and it became sort of a medical mystery, even though I've been seeing the same GI doctor for basically as long as I've been in DC, for about 15 years, and we did a number of tests and couldn't figure anything out, so I sort of started to seek, you know, a second opinion outside of his advice. I was having a lot of trouble, really. I felt nauseous most mornings. I felt like I had no energy. I was very uncomfortable most of the time, and it was really impacting actually my ability to do my job, because I couldn't feel like normal energy levels. I couldn't concentrate very well on work, and I was really struggling. I'm really active normally, and I work out probably about 5 days a week, and I was trying to keep that up, but just the sapping of my energy. I'm usually a morning workout person. I like to go and get it over with before I go into my office. And there were just a lot of days where I was struggling just to get myself out of bed and get myself to work and work a full day. And I was really frustrated too, because we couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I went on a bout of really rough antibiotics for a couple of weeks where my diet was pretty restricted, and I was told it was going to be rough, but hopefully after I let that run its course, I would feel better. And it really didn't help. So I finally got in touch with Kelly Dorfman, who's a nutritionist, and I told her a lot about my history and the problems I've been having. And I explained to her, I'm an Italian woman, and I love my pasta and my pizza and my bread, and I've been tested more than once for celiac disease, and every time it came back negative. I've had food allergy testing done, and nothing was really showing up or making sense. And she said to me, well, I bet when you go over to Italy and you eat your pasta and your pizza and everything there, you're probably fine, right? And I said, yeah, actually. Funny you say that, I am, but I do struggle here.
That's curious. We'll hear more from Christine in the next segment. Also on today's show, we'll make a gluten-free dish and take a look at some GMOs and talk to two special guests. But first, the news. In the headlines today, organic foods, less pesticides, herbicides for harvest, and wheat protein, pro-inflammatory. Despite food safety controls, an organic diet provides significantly less exposure to pesticides. A recent study assigned two adults in Germany to a conventional diet for 11 days with morning urine collections for the last 4 days of this period. They were then switched to exclusively organic food for 18 days, and likewise morning urine collection on the last 4 days of this period. The urine samples were tested for more than 25 pesticides from 7 classes of toxins, including herbicides and insecticides. In keeping with previous studies, levels were significantly lower after eating organic food for all but 2 toxins in one of the individuals. Another reminder for us to reduce exposure whenever we get the chance. Grain and legume producers in northern temperate regions usually apply pre-harvest desiccants to dry the crops and facilitate harvesting to prevent spoilage and enhance efficiency. It seems to make good sense until you realise that desiccants are actually herbicides. A recent study from Saskatchewan, Canada, evaluated various herbicides to find which one was the best harvest aid for red lentils. The study found the herbicide Diquat alone or in combination with glyphosate gave the most consistent dehulling efficiency and increased milling recovery, though the higher the glyphosate residue on the seeds, the lower the rates of subsequent seed germination, seed vigour, dehulling efficiency and milling recovery. The authors therefore recommended that lentil growers use Diquat alone or in combination with glyphosate for optimal milling recovery. Helpful advice to a lentil grower, alarming advice to a lentil consumer. If they're not organic, be sure to wash your grains and legumes in plenty of running water. Wheat protein appears to trigger an excess immune reaction in some children with non-celiac gluten sensitivity, or NCGS. That's a newly characterized and evolving clinical condition that requires ruling out of celiac disease and wheat allergy. And there are no measurable biomarkers with which to diagnose it. To find the trigger, researchers in Italy cultured immune cells from the blood of 11 children with NCGS, 18 with active celiac disease, and 16 healthy controls. When exposed to wheat proteins, excessive amounts of pro-inflammatory chemicals were produced by the immune cells growing from the children with NCGS. Proteins from modern wheat activated a greater response than proteins from ancient wheat. However, the reason for the overreaction remains unproven. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. The first guest on the show today is Dr. Stephanie Seneff, Senior Research Scientist at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. There she works in computer science, but has an interest in the herbicide glyphosate. We have designer crops that are Roundup Ready, or GM, to resist glyphosate. And from a human perspective, glyphosate has been promoted as a safe weed killer since its inception in the 70s. In view of her concerns, I asked Dr. Seneff why glyphosate was initially thought to be harmless to humans.
We're told that glyphosate is harmless to humans because we don't possess the pathway, the biological pathway that it disrupts in the plants, which is the shikimate pathway.
Now, that makes scientific sense if we don't have that pathway, but you're saying that glyphosate does actually cause harm. Why is that?
Well, one of the ways is because it affects the shikimate pathway in the microbes that are in the gut. Our gut microbes use the shikimate pathway to produce essential amino acids for us. These are the aromatic amino acids. And we depend upon them to produce those molecules because our own cells cannot produce them. So when the microbes are harmed by the glyphosate, we become deficient in these amino acids, which are precursors to many important biological molecules, including neurotransmitters and hormones.
So that's going to affect brain health and presumably gut health as well.
That's right. Critically gut health, actually. And we're seeing an epidemic in gut disorders these days. And gut dysbiosis is linked to things like celiac disease and autism that we are also seeing in epidemic proportions these days.
Now, we're also seeing a lot of gluten intolerance as well. Do you think those
Yes.
two are related? And if so, how?
Most definitely. I actually believe that gluten intolerance is a direct consequence of the widespread practice these days of spraying wheat with glyphosate just before the harvest as a desiccant. Wheat is not among those plants that are engineered to be Roundup Ready. Those are the core plants of the processed food industry, the corn, the soy, the canola, the sugar beets. Those are all engineered to resist Roundup. Wheat is not. Wheat is not GMO. But it is sprayed with Roundup before the harvest intentionally in order to kill it. And that Roundup goes directly into the seed and ends up in the wheat products. And we've seen high levels of glyphosate in wheat products that have been tested, including things like Oreo cookies and Goldfish crackers and Cheerios. I mean, things that are very popular foods among small children.
Right, and you're pointing out small children because they are more at risk of the effects of toxins, I presume.
That is absolutely true. Children are much more sensitive to the toxic chemicals in our environment. And of course, we're in a wash of toxic chemicals these days. We've been very happy to develop all these new chemicals through the past 50, 100 years with extremely inadequate testing. And glyphosate, I think, really slipped through the cracks. It was inadequately tested. It was approved prematurely. And now we're paying a huge price.
And I was unaware of this use of glyphosate, not really as a weed killer, but as a desiccant to dry
yes.
out these crops before they're harvested. How long has this been happening?
Well, it was an idea, I think, that was developed actually quite a long time ago, maybe in the 1990s, but it didn't really become popular until more recently, I would say in the last 10 years. And we see a dramatic increase in the use of glyphosate on wheat. You can actually look at the data from the U.S. government that they provide, and specifically on wheat, and you can see that that matches very well with a rise in celiac disease and gluten intolerance. Those two curves line up temporally. The temporal trends of the increase in gluten intolerance corresponds to the increase in the use of glyphosate on wheat.
So there may be an association between the two. Now it's time to think about this.
What you doing?
Oh, I'm mulching these vegetables. They're organic, you know.
Oh, that's a really good idea because all the vegetables in the market are full of pesticides, aren't they?
So is that fish you're eating.
What?
Yeah.
No way. We all know that the biggest concern with pesticides is with vegetables and fruits, not with fish.
Oh, really? You've never heard of biomagnification?
Biomagnificent?
Biomagnification. You know, the big fish eat lots of little fish, but eat tons of phytoplankton plants living in pesticide-contaminated waters. And so as you go up the food chain, the concentration of pesticide gets magnified up to 10,000 times.
Oh, and I'm eating it?
Uh-huh. Happens with most meat.
Oh, no. So this is a chemical warehouse?
That's right.
So I should have ordered that phytoplankton burger instead,
huh? Go vegetarian. Reduce your pesticides, herbicides, toxic chemicals, and your heavy metals. Doctor's orders.
Welcome back. Now, Phil and I are in the kitchen, and we are not going to cook today, Phil.
So if we're not cooking, should we leave?
No, let's just go ahead and cook, but uncook.
This is going to be a fun one.
Okay, so what are we making?
So today we're making raw, uncooked couscous salad. And we're going to use a quarter cauliflower, chopped roughly, 4 finely diced tomatoes, half of an English cucumber peeled, finely diced, 3 green onions, finely chopped, a large bunch of finely chopped flat leaf parsley, a tablespoon of finely chopped fresh mint, 2 tablespoons olive oil, 2 teaspoons of fresh lemon juice, and half a teaspoon of salt. So there's a lot of chopping, but this looks like a great recipe of fresh foods.
Yes, this is high nutrient value, low calorie. So let's start with our cauliflower. And what we're going to do is take the insides out and just chop what we need. Why don't you start on the parsley? Because for couscous, we need a lot of parsley, right? Because that's what's going to give it all that wonderful flavor. And parsley is loaded with antioxidants and vitamins, so.
It's something that I find a lot of people are a little bit scared of because it can have a bitter taste. But I feel like it's a great thing to get yourself used to and accustomed to because you've got great nutrients in there.
That's right. And it doesn't matter how small or large we cut this collie because it's all going to go in the food processor and we're going to turn it into cauliflower rice, as everyone calls it. But in this case, it's going to be cauliflower couscous.
Now, did you know it's a cruciferous vegetable? I learned this just recently. Have you heard that before?
Oh, yes.
Do you know why it's called a cruciferous vegetable?
No.
It's called that along with broccoli and cabbage. And
yep.
It's called that because the flowers are 4 petals and they form something very similar to the Greek cross.
Right. Well, I'm going to make noise now. Here we go. And there we have it. I just cooked the couscous. I'm sorry. I uncooked it. And those are very fancy scissors you've got.
These are actually a lot of fun. You got to be a little bit careful because you've got several several blades here, but these are fun.
Yeah, you like gadgets.
I always love a new kitchen gadget.
All right. I'm going to take this white scraper here and put this white couscous in. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right.
I want to make sure I get all of that parsley there.
And you know, the secret to add taste to a salad is really in the dressing, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, the parsley is, of course, the parsley and the mint in this, but the dressing is kind of what really finishes a salad off. So
what are we putting as far as the dressing in
this? We are going to put some olive oil and lemon juice. That's actually my favorite dressing, but you do the stirring because you're very good at that.
This cauliflower, to me, this is fascinating because you wouldn't know that that's cauliflower.
No, you wouldn't. Looking at it? Nuh-uh. Can you give that a little scrape out? I'd hate to miss out on cucumbers. One of my favorite salad ingredients.
No, I love the crisp flavor. It's very refreshing, too, especially in a salad like this.
Yeah, and then those green onions, again, going to add extra zing to this dish. I guess we'll add a little salt. And I must say, my favorite oil in a salad is either olive oil or flaxseed oil.
Oh, flaxseed. Now, that's one that most people probably aren't comfortable with or know much about.
That's right. It's more expensive. So a couple of tablespoons each of those.
So this dressing is just olive oil or some sort of oil, lemon juice, and then salt.
And salt, that's right.
That's so easy.
Yes, you've done all the hard work, I think. I got to press a button.
This is the fun part.
And we did the chopping, yes. I think we're ready. I'm looking forward to tasting this.
I am too. Now this, I have not had anything like this. This is a brand new recipe to me, especially with cauliflower like this. This is new and I'm excited about it.
Mm-mm.
Oh, and it's just, the colors are amazing.
Look at
that's
that.
That's a gorgeous
and
salad.
And you even left a nice big piece to just go there in the middle.
As garnish.
Yeah. All right. Chomp away.
Mmm. That is very good.
It is. That is a keeper for me.
I love the lemon taste. I love lemon, especially with vegetables. And that, to me, it's not too much, but it does pop out to you, and it's great flavors.
Mmm. And it's so quick and easy.
Thank you so much. This has been a really great recipe. This is going to go in the recipe box.
Very good. I hope it goes in yours too.
Christine had a cluster of gastrointestinal symptoms that seemed to resolve when she ate pizza and pasta in Italy, but would return when she ate the same things in the US. Her nutritionist worked with her to suggest a possible explanation.
And she explained to me about how this chemicals being used on the wheat products in our country, and so really everything for the most part, all those same kinds of products that are made here with American developed flour, if it's not organic, it's going to have this chemical in it. And it's really been started, you know, to being used more prevalently in the last 10 years here, which sort of explains the same time frame when I've been having additional issues. And so she said, I really think this is your issue because you're not allergic to celiac and you think you feel a little better when you don't have gluten type products in your diet, but you don't want to give those things up because it doesn't make sense to you. And I said, yeah, exactly. So she asked me to do an experiment just to test out her theory. And she said, you probably know where the legit Italian pizzerias are in the area. And I said, of course I do. So she said, you know, those pizzerias have to use the special 00 flour from Italy. And I said, yeah, that's part of the way they get the special seal of approval from Naples to be a, you know, a verified pizzeria. And so she said, okay, go a couple weeks, go completely gluten-free, and then see how you feel. And if you feel good, then try to go and eat at one of those pizza places. And she said, if I'm right, you're still going to feel just fine. And she was right. Before I did the change, you know, I'd sort of go off and on with trying to be gluten-free. I eat pretty healthy for the most part, lots of, you know, lean proteins, lots of vegetables. But like I said, I like to have, you know, my bread or my pasta or my pizza a few times a week. And I just was getting so miserable whenever I would have anything like that. And it was just so frustrating to me. So then I switched it up and I did feel better, and I still now just kind of follow that. And take it a step further too, I, you know, try to avoid a lot of the corn products because I've noticed a sensitivity to those. And it's funny because probably 6 months or so ago, I started to be kind of lax about the things that I was eating. I wasn't making sure that anything I had as far as a sort of a gluten or a wheat type product was with the organic flour. Started dating a new guy, and he was, you know, you don't want to be that person who's always got this very specific diet. And so I started to have a lot more of that back into my diet, and I started to have problems again. And one thing that popped up that I'd never experienced before was I got like canker sores all over my tongue and in my mouth, and I just couldn't understand what the issue was. I thought it was something to do with tartness. You know, I thought I just had too much of a citrus drink or something. And my dentist even gave me a prescription for some like a mouthwash I could use and some other gel to put on it, and they would go away, and then weeks later they just popped back up again, and they were so painful and so frustrating. And so I called Kelly back and I said, what do you think's going on? You know, I'm trying to actually wean off of my acid reflux medication because that's something that she and I have been working on too, and I thought maybe it was some sort of imbalance with the acid changes while I was trying to taper off that medication. And she said, did you start eating a lot of gluten again? I was like, yeah, I did. I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. She was like, I think that's probably part of it. You have to be so careful. You're sensitive to this chemical, and if you're not careful, this is the kind of thing that can happen to you. So she was like, dude, try it for me. Go, you know, 3 weeks, no gluten. Don't even touch your usual stuff that you know is, you know, the organic flour or whatever, and see how you feel. And she's like, check out the article I wrote, you know, online. There's some stuff about this. And again, she was right. I mean, they went away and they've never come back.
Nice to see the back of them. In the last segment, today's guest, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, mentioned that glyphosate blocks the production of some neurotransmitters by gut bacteria. I asked her if she suspects a link between glyphosate and neurological disease.
Yes, I absolutely think so. And in fact, again, you see very strong correlations. One of the first things that I did was to look at a lot of medical data and looking at time trends of diseases. And it's quite alarming when you look at the United States. A number of different neurological diseases that are increasing dramatically. Of course, autism is an important one, and that's growing exponentially. Alzheimer's disease and dementia are also growing exponentially in this country. Very worrisome because it's such a burden on the healthcare costs of the country. And multiple sclerosis and ALS. I actually wrote an entire paper linking glyphosate to Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a crippling disease. When you're diagnosed with it, you have about 5 years left to live, and it's a very painful life with complete deterioration of your muscles, and inability to move, and ultimately an inability to breathe. It's a really nasty disease, going up very dramatically, and in fact connected to agricultural exposure to chemicals. That's been shown in epidemiological studies.
So you're saying that glyphosate potentially could be affecting children, middle-aged, and the elderly neurologically?
Absolutely, all age groups, and you get different manifestation of disease for really the same process, I think. And it relates to the toxic metals as well, aluminum and mercury, even manganese. And these metals are, glyphosate binds very strongly to these metals, and it can bring them into the brain. And I think it gets into the brain stem and messes up the pineal gland, causing sleep disorder, which is another thing that has gone up dramatically in this country, in step with these diseases are often linked to sleep disorder, and sleep disorder by itself has become a very big problem in our country. I think it's because of the disruption of the melatonin, which is a direct product of the chicken mate pathway. So that's one of the hormones, you might say, that are disrupted by glyphosate.
Now, does glyphosate also affect the nutrients within the food?
Yes, in fact, glyphosate causes an inability of the plant to absorb minerals in particular, and so you get deficiencies in sulfur, iron, zinc, I mean, all of these important manganese, cobalt, these micronutrients. These are things that you need in very small amounts, but they are really critical for certain enzymes that depend upon these metals as catalysts for the enzymes. And they are going to be, because of glyphosate's effect as a metal chelator, it hangs on very tightly to these minerals and doesn't allow the plant to absorb them, and also disrupts the their availability to the gut microbes, which messes them up, and then finally to our own cells. So there's really a very disrupted mineral homeostasis in the presence of glyphosate.
Now, who monitors levels of glyphosate in our crops? Is there any monitoring going on, and what sort of standards are being used?
The U.S. government does report on the amount of glyphosate being used on certain core crops. They do some sampling, and they have some data on the web, which I've used to correlate with all the health issues that we're seeing. Glyphosate usage on the corn, the soy, the canola, mostly the corn and soy, actually. We've gotten data from corn and soy, and as I said, also on wheat. But they don't, they've been very sloppy in measuring the amount of glyphosate in the food itself. The U.S. government has taken the point of view that glyphosate is non-toxic to humans, and therefore it doesn't matter how much glyphosate is in the foods. So it has really become the responsibility of citizens to do that. And we've had activist groups that have measured, have taken the initiative to measure glyphosate levels in certain foods. And we're, and the Canadian government, I think, has been more responsive than the U.S. government. And I have a friend who's an activist in Canada. His name is Tony Mitra. He's done a wonderful job of getting the Canadian government to give him their data on glyphosate contamination in food, and he's been pouring through it. One of the things that was very surprising to me was extremely high levels in things like in legumes, like chickpeas and hummus, you know, these kinds of Mediterranean foods that you that I enjoy. Those were coming out with extremely high levels of glyphosate, and they too are being sprayed with glyphosate right before the harvest. This was something I wasn't previously aware of. So you can be surprised by which foods might have it. And as I said, the cereals, the anything based on wheat, soy, corn, sugars, sugarcane is sprayed with glyphosate right before the harvest. So many of the basic foods are contaminated with glyphosate, and we're getting a chronic daily exposure in our food unless we eat organic. And even with organic, it's still coming out present in much smaller amounts in organic foods.
So that would be the way to go to avoid this exposure?
I am very, very careful. At home, we buy only organic food, including our spices, our wine. Everything is organic in our household. We're very strict about it. Much harder to do when you eat out, so we don't eat out very much. But when we do, we worry about what how much glyphosate we're getting in that food.
Now, you were saying that there are mineral deficiencies, potentially mineral deficiencies from eating food that's been exposed to glyphosate. Is that if they've been exposed all the way through the plant's lifespan, and or is it just even as a desiccant at the end of their lifespan?
Well, that's a question I'm not prepared to answer, unfortunately. I don't think the research has been done, and I actually don't know the answer to that. That is a good question to ask. But not only is it depleted in the foods, but it's also disrupted in our body. So even if it might be available, for example, iron, glyphosate messes up the process by which iron is transported and delivered to the tissues. And so you can get both iron toxicity and iron deficiency at the same time. Same thing is true for manganese. And I'm seeing that. In fact, it's very clear to me that manganese deficiency is linked to autism. I've written about that. And the manganese was found to be extremely low in the blood in cows exposed to glyphosate. They tested for glyphosate. They had glyphosate in their urine. They had extremely low manganese and extremely low cobalt in their blood, two critical minerals that were basically just completely stolen by the glyphosate and made unavailable. that really causes serious repercussions to the way the mineral is managed in your body. Even if you are eating enough of it, if you're taking, for example, supplements, you may not be using it correctly, and you may actually end up causing toxicity. Manganese, excess manganese in the brain can cause something called manganism that looks very much like Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's is another one of those neurological diseases that's linked to agricultural exposure to chemicals.
Though I have to admit, it is usually pesticides other than glyphosate that do that. Now consider this. The thing that sets Jehovah apart from other gods is his creative power. It's recorded in Genesis. In 1 week, he filled the earth, first with light, atmosphere, and land. Then the sun, moon, and stars, the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, and the creatures on the land. Then us, made in his image. His final creative act was a day for rest, rejuvenation, and reverence. A paradise that thrilled the senses. Adam and Eve were tasked to keep the garden, and that grew harder when sin brought the curse of weeds and pests. Now, instead of hard labor, man has resorted to chemicals. That's brought pollution, chemical resistance, and an increase in the number and volume of chemicals used. Pollinators are tiny creatures that have suffered from all this activity. Hummingbirds, moths, butterflies, wasps, and bees. One of my favorite is the honeybee, probably because I love honey. They're so small and apparently insignificant, yet it's been said that if the honeybee disappears from the surface of the globe, then man would only have 4 years of life left. No more bees, no more pollination, no more plants, no more animals, and no more man. Of course, there are other pollinators, and not all plants need pollination. But it's a sobering thought to realize that nowadays, beekeepers lose 40% of their bees from colony collapse disorder every year. And while we don't know why, I don't think that pesticides help at all. So why don't we all do our small part to take care of God's green earth? When it comes to GMOs, there are about 10 or 11 that are really common in America. One is aspartame, and that's in a lot of, as a sweetener in a lot of foods. Soy, though most of the soy that's GM is fed to cattle. Corn, the same, although we eat some of that too, but corn, high fructose corn syrup and sweeteners and corn oil, papaya from Hawaii, canola and cotton oil, sugar beets, yellow and zucchini squash, potatoes, and alfalfa, which is another feed crop, and apples. Now, there are a number of those that are resistant to glyphosate, which is a broad-spectrum systemic herbicide and crop desiccant. As a chemical, it was created in the 50s, but only discovered to be a herbicide by a Monsanto chemist in 1970. By 1974, it was rolling out the door under the name Roundup, and Monsanto's commercially relevant US patent expired in 2000. So a lot of companies are now making glyphosate-based herbicides. By 2007, glyphosate was the most commonly used herbicide in the US in the agricultural sector, second most common in the home and garden. The commonest in the home and garden was 2,4-D. Now, that year, about 86,000 tons of glyphosate was used in the US. Of course, a lot more if we count the whole world. Now, glyphosate can be used in different ways. One study compared residues of glyphosate and its metabolite AMPA in organic soy, which received no glyphosate, conventional soy, where glyphosate was sprayed in between the crop cycles, not during a crop growing period. And then, of course, Ready Roundup soy, which a lot of these crops are prepared for, that was sprayed on the plants during the growing season. And researchers were surprised to find no glyphosate or AMPA residues in either the organic or the conventional soy. In the Roundup Ready soy, though, there were high levels of glyphosate and AMPA, so high that the safety levels of residues was raised in response. Well, since weeds became resistant, there has been a 100-fold increase in the use of glyphosate since the late 70s. And glyphosate is used for crop desiccation as well to increase the yield just at the time of harvest. It's used in sugar to increase the sucrose concentration on sugarcane before harvest. It's applied to grains like wheat, barley and oats to kill the plant as it dries the crop more quickly and evenly, and then you can actually harvest while it's still standing. You don't need to swathe it and allow it to dry in the field. And that is common in practice in climates that have a short growing season, so the northern or the southern climates. Now, one meta-analysis was published in 2014 suggesting that workers who are in glyphosate factories have a higher risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The WHO, in response, their International Agency for Research on Cancer, classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic in humans. Of course, that was studies done in occupational exposure, not in the general population, who are eating these foods, and typically the glyphosate measured in parts per million. What was interesting is one study looked at glyphosate exposure in parts per billion or per trillion, that's even smaller. And they showed that increased cell proliferation of hormone-dependent breast cancers was stimulated by glyphosate, not in the hormone-independent breast cancer cells. But that tells us that possibly low and environmentally relevant concentrations of glyphosate will increase estrogenic activity. We're still waiting for studies on living, breathing humans. It's not been done, but it's pretty difficult when GMO foods remain unlabeled. Now, Roundup is not the same as glyphosate. It contains adjuvants and surfactants that help to penetrate into the weeds. Now, when it's applied to human placental tissue, it was found to be toxic, even at levels found in the fields, found in our weeds. Similar results are found from applying other major pesticides to placental tissue, but Roundup was 125 times more toxic than glyphosate on its own, and was by far the most toxic of all the pesticides tested. So which of these is Roundup ready and therefore drenched in Roundup during its growing season? That would be soy, corn, canola, and alfalfa. Many given to animals, but not all.
Would you like to reduce your risk of prostate cancer by 40%? The Adventist Health Study found not one, but two ways to do it. Men who regularly enjoy dried fruits, like raisins, prunes, or dried apricots, were 40% less likely to develop prostate cancer. And the men who ate a lot of tomatoes, fresh, canned, or otherwise, reduced their risk of prostate cancer by 40% or more. Regularly enjoying tomatoes and dried fruits is another ageless advantage.
It's question time. Your questions. Here's our first question. Someone texted, I'm 43, have uterine fibroids, but don't want surgery. Is it possible to shrink them naturally? Well, an ideal lifestyle will help. Get your body mass index as close to 20 as possible so that there's less estrogen circulating from fat tissue. A whole food plant-based diet will be important too, because then you will eliminate animal sources of hormones or growth factors that will encourage the fibroid to grow. Take regular exercise and every day have a little bit of soy, not too much. Don't overdo it, but have at least one serving of soy every day, and that will hopefully block some of your natural estrogen. Perhaps you can use bioidentical progesterone cream to balance any excess estrogen out. Now, your fibroids may not shrink, but hopefully you can prevent them from growing any further. Once you reach menopause, they're going to shrink if you don't use hormone replacement therapy, because the estrogen levels will fall. So if you can, don't use hormone replacement and you'll be able to shrink them in the future. Glenda asks if using a silicon mat at the bottom of the oven can cause cancer. Well, silicon is a synthetic rubber, and it contains bonded silicon, which is an element that's abundant in sand and rock. I still prefer stainless and glass cookware because it's a relatively new product and long-term studies are not out there yet, but you're not putting it in contact with food, so I don't see a problem. Someone texted, what causes hypertension? How can I prevent it?
There are so many causes, but the most common cause of hypertension has a silly name called essential hypertension, which means we don't know. But I can tell you that in low-income countries, essential hypertension doesn't exist. That means it's due to our diet and our lifestyle. So prevent it by being active, having an ideal weight, avoiding salt, saturated fat, cholesterol, and processed foods. Be sure that you're drinking enough water and manage stress. Surround yourself with supportive friends and loved ones so that you can get your stress levels down. Now, remember, if you have a question, send it in by Facebook, text, phone, or contact us on the website. Like us on Facebook and become part of our Go Healthy for Good community. Now, let's see what's in the store today. Lemons are the most commonly used citrus. They're native to Asia, but they've migrated all over the world. We use their juice and their zest more than we use their pulp, so look for smooth, brightly coloured skin. And if the fruit feels heavy for its size, then it should be nice and juicy. The juice is useful to preserve foods that oxidise and discolour quickly, like apples, bananas, or avocados. Once squeezed, there's a quick loss of vitamin C, so be sure to drink your lemonade right away. Recent animal research suggests that citrus have anti-cancer properties. Also, if you want to alkalinize your body in the mornings, then squeeze fresh lemon juice into your morning water. But be careful, it will erode the enamel on your teeth. So you better use a straw. Bon appetit. The next guest on today's show is Kelly Dorfman. She's a clinical nutritionist, author, and speaker. I asked her about GMOs.
The word they're using is genetically modified organisms, which is how you describe a crop. And it sounds funny, like an organism to describe a plant, but that's because you're using DNA, usually from bacteria, which is technically, I guess, in the animal kingdom, in the plant with specific characteristics. And the most popular characteristics is resistance to Roundup or glyphosate.
What's the advantage for the farmer?
Well, imagine you have a lot of weeds and you have a corn crop. And you can either hire a lot of people to go and weed the corn crop so that the weeds don't overtake it, or you can spray it with Roundup and the weeds all die because they're not resistant to the herbicide and the corn survives. So it's an enormous savings in terms of labor costs.
Now tell us what's happened to the crops over time the amount of Roundup.
The promise was we would be able to use less herbicide with this and there would be a great savings, there would be increased crop yields. But the recent research has found that the crop yields are not going up anymore. They're sort of flattened out now, and in fact we're using more and more of the herbicide. So the promise has not really panned out, unfortunately.
So there was initially some increase in yield with these new crops.
Yes.
But the amount of glyphosate that is required to kill the weeds has gone up because the weeds have become resistant.
And not only that, the seeds, you need certain kinds of seeds, so the cost goes up for that. This has been a big problem in third world countries like India, where you can't really use the farmers in poor countries collect their seeds and reuse them, but you can't do that with these kind of seeds. You have to buy them fresh every year, and it's expensive. It's very expensive.
So there's the social element.
There's a social element,
and political element,
yes,
to it as,
yes,
well, and economic. So which are the crops that use glyphosate? Which crops are genetically engineered in this country?
About 85% of corn, about 95% of soy. That's a pretty high percentage. Almost all of the papaya crops, a lot of canola crops, and a lot of sugar.
Right. So I noticed it's Hawaiian papaya. I don't,
yes,
know if you grow papaya anywhere else.
I don't know
America.
That you can grow it in Maryland.
But if it's an American grower,
yes,
it's probably from Hawaii. And then you said the
canola and sugar and soy and corn.
Right.
Those are the big GMO crops.
And the thing about soy and corn is most of that is fed to animals. Right, that's animal feed in this country.
Well, that's true, but 80 to 90% of processed food now has some GMO component in it. So that's a lot.
That is a lot, because from the corn we're not eating the corn as much as we're eating the corn syrup.
Soda. Even a baby formula has corn solids in it. And in fact, one mother advocacy group tested a baby formula and found about a third of the samples contain glyphosate residues that are higher than they wanted levels.
Wow. Now, so in your opinion, does eating genetically engineered foods or GMOs affect health just in and of themselves?
I think so, but for a long time there was the thought that it was because the proteins were foreign, because we're introducing these bacteria proteins. But now with this new information about you can't separate the GMOs from the herbicide they're putting on. So you're not really eating a GMO food that doesn't have herbicide tied to it. So we don't really know what part of the GMO could be an issue. It may not be the foreign proteins after all. It may be, in fact, that we're eating so much more herbicide. Don't forget, nobody thought we'd be eating the herbicide. You wouldn't spray your roses and then eat them, or you wouldn't kill your plants in your garden and then eat them. So this is a whole new idea that didn't cross anybody's mind. So those kind of research studies aren't here. We don't really know what happens when people eat a lot of this.
Right, because this is a brave new world.
A brave new world.
Right. Now, going back to, as you were pointing out, there is genetic engineering and then there's genetic engineering.
Right.
So tease that out for us.
I think it's a really important point. It's very confusing. So we are almost all the food you're eating has been somewhat genetically modified through a process called hybridization, which is basically selective mating for certain traits. And farmers have been doing this for hundreds, if not thousands of years, since the first apple came over. I mean, you couldn't eat a regular apple that has not been genetically modified. They're sour, they're small, they're not tasty. Same with tomatoes, almost all crops have been selectively mated for certain characteristics. That is a form of genetic modification, but it is not inserting a foreign protein. And that's the difference. In genetically modified organisms, you're actually inserting this protein. And these seeds can't reproduce themselves, and so you have to provide them new every year. And in just characteristic shifting, you're saying, well, I want corn that's sweeter, so I'm going to breed this corn with this corn. That's different. That seems to be safe, and we've been doing that forever.
Right. And so tell us, there's a lot of discussion about what has happened to wheat in this regard, the hybridization and the amount of gluten and all of this. So.
Yes, and for a long time, we thought that was the reigning theory, was that people were reacting more and more to wheat because of the genetic modification through picking certain characteristics. We went from wheat that was very tall, like those pictures of the waving grains, the field, to these stubby little wheat crops. That's what a lot of wheat looks like now. It's shorter, it's higher in protein. Actually, a gentleman won the Nobel Prize in the 70s for this because the increased protein was really good for third world countries where protein was at a premium. So it's a higher protein crop, and so that was the thought. But now that's all been thrown into the air. We're not sure. Maybe it really isn't the increased protein. Maybe the protein's just fine, and it's these other chemical alterations.
We have more from Kelly Dorfman after the break, so don't go away. As an Italian living in America, Christine loved her pizza, pasta, and bread. However, after talking with Kelly Dorfman, she realized that her gastrointestinal upsets would resolve when she stopped eating gluten, even though she tested negative for celiac disease. Here's how life is now.
I feel great overall. Yeah, I mean, I got my energy back and everything, and I don't feel sick in the mornings. You know, as long as I stay away from it, I really feel really healthy. But sometimes I can kind of tell, oh, you know, something I had must have had, you know, some of that involved. And I try, you know, I like to go out to the Italian restaurant, but I feel like a lot of those places, they're making their pasta in-house with the good flour, and I know for sure where the pizza places are that use the 00 flour. So I try to just stick to what I know and, you know, still try some new things, but I think the nicer restaurants here in the city do take pride in their ingredients, and that makes a big difference. I think a lot of us grew up on similar diets with a lot of wheat-based products, you know, especially just a basic thing like packing a sandwich for lunch. a lot of people I've talked to said, well, what am I going to do? I can't eat a sandwich anymore. I've got to think about all these other things to try to make myself. And I was like, yeah, it's a change. And sometimes it's inconvenient. You know, you go out to dinner with friends. Or for example, I was at lunch today with some coworkers, and we were ordering tapas, and everyone was going to share. But it was a little bit difficult for me because I had to ask that at least a few of the things be gluten-free. There's a lot of options, and a few things that they got weren't okay for me, and I just didn't eat them. But I think sometimes you don't realize how kind of bad you feel on a daily basis until you get to a point where you don't feel that way. And then you look back and you say, wow, you know, this is great. I'm not distracted by my digestive issues. You know, I think that the health benefit that you get and the way you feel, the difference in the way you feel on a daily basis and energy levels for me and my ability to concentrate, really, it was such an improvement that it's really worth it to me.
I asked today's guest, Kelly Dorfman, how the hybridization of wheat has changed the product that we get now and whether that is clinically relevant.
Well, it appears to be higher in protein for the most part, but the taste is not very different. I don't think that a person could probably find it in a taste test. They do sell these heirloom wheats now. You can buy them at the health food store or online that have not been mated so much and changed for characteristics. And some people use that and find that that settles with them better. But for the most part, we have yet to tease out what exactly is affecting people who don't have celiac disease but do seem to be wheat intolerant, which is 5 to 6 times more people than people who are actually diagnosed with celiac disease. So this is a big problem.
Now, I'm just going to go back a little bit.
Go ahead.
How much increase has there been in the gluten content of wheat? Has it been significant? Is that an issue for people or not?
It has been significant, but it's been over a really long period of time. I mean, the man who won the Nobel Prize, it was in the 70s. So you're talking about 50 years. So this has been happening slowly over a long period of time. So it's unclear if that is really the issue with it. As time goes on and we're discovering these new ideas, this pre-harvesting idea that Dr. Seneff was talking about, this didn't occur to any of us when we were looking at why, in my practice, suddenly all these people complained that they couldn't eat wheat. And interestingly, they would go to Europe for vacation in the summer, eat croissants all the way through France, and be fine, and come back and get sick. And this made no sense to me. And their doctors would say, well, you must be stressed out. But as I saw this in France, in Italy, in Croatia, and all these different countries, I started wondering, what else about the wheat could be going on? And that's when Dr. Seneff and other researchers started raising the alarm that perhaps it's not the protein content at all. Perhaps the problem really is this processing, which is not happening a lot in most European countries, although it is happening to some extent in England and a little bit in India.
Mm. Now, you mentioned the celiac disease and wheat sensitivity or intolerance. Just explain those two terms to us.
There's a physiological process where you have these little finger-like projections that help to increase your digestive area in the intestine. If your intestine was like this, there wouldn't be much digestion, but there's these little fingers that help you increase this absorption area. That all flattens out in celiac disease, and you can see that when you do the endoscopy. So it's an autoimmune disease where you're attacking your own gut lining when you eat wheat. And this happens in about 1 in 100 or 1 in 120 people, depending on what numbers you're looking at. About 5 to 6 times that number of people complain that they can't tolerate gluten, but they do not have celiac disease. This number is so large that they actually came out with a disease that they didn't have a test for, which they were calling for a while non-celiac gluten sensitivity. That seems to be in limbo at the moment. But there are enough people that most people that are avoiding gluten are not avoiding it because they have celiac disease, but are avoiding it because they are symptomatic when they eat it and have many of the symptoms of celiac disease but don't have celiac disease.
So what sort of symptoms might they notice?
Gas, bloating, loose stools, cramping. Sometimes there are other kinds of symptoms, neurological symptoms like headaches. I saw somebody this week with joint pain. That's another common symptom. Occasionally see rashes, although there is a rash called dermatitis herpetiformis that goes with celiac disease. But there are other kinds of rashes that don't, that can also be an issue.
And how long might these symptoms come after eating wheat or gluten?
Well, that's a problem. It's not like lactose intolerance where you drink the milk and within an hour you're running to the bathroom. It can sometimes be the next day, and bloating can take a while because bloating comes from fermentation of what you're eating in your colon, and it can take 24 hours or more to get through your colon, so it might be the next day that you're still bloated.
So how would you advise someone to kind of figure it out? What's your advice to someone to, as a nutritionist, you're seeing these people, how do you figure it out for them, or how do you help them with that?
Well, people wish that there was a nice, lovely blood test, and they spend a lot of time and money looking for that lovely blood test, but we don't seem to have it. So the best test is really just eliminating it and seeing. Get rid of all the gluten that you can. You don't have to be calling the manufacturer and making sure they're not rolling their potato chips in flour. Sometimes there's hidden gluten, but bread and noodles and crackers, just get rid of it for about a month. And I say a month because life happens, and if you do it a short period of time, you may not see the difference. You know, your mother might visit, the kids get sick from school, you know, all these things happen that interfere with your ability to watch a pattern. So you want to do it long enough that you can see, oh, I seem to be doing better. And you can keep a record on your phone or on an old calendar of your symptoms, because you know how we forget what we had for breakfast yesterday, let alone whether we were bloated on Monday, right?
Right. So keep a diary.
Keep a diary.
And do that for a month. At the end of the month, what do you do?
Then you just sit down and eat some. And in many cases, what I've had people do is just try organic wheat. Only eat organic or heirloom wheat and see if they can tolerate that first. And then if they can, then they can see if commercial wheat is a problem, because the problem is we don't know which wheat crops are laced with glyphosate. Some are perfectly fine. Some farmers do not do this practice at all, and others are full of it. So you could have pizza at one place and be fine, and this is one of the things that's confusing for people. I had pizza last week, I was fine at, you know, Guido's, and then I went to Mario's and I didn't do so well. And we don't know what the source of that flour is.
When it comes to glyphosate, it seems a good idea to avoid eating crops that have been genetically modified for herbicide resistance, because we know that they have been drenched with glyphosate during their growing cycle. Replace those ones with organics. And if you have gastrointestinal symptoms after eating gluten, you might want to see your doctor to rule out celiac disease. And if it's negative, consider non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.